learning from Solomon's life. The book of Kings, as I said when we began this series, actually answers, among other things, the great question, how did we get from the heights of up here King David and the extraordinary wealth and power of Solomon to the depths of the Boney M. Christmas Carol by the rivers of Babylon, there where we wept when we remembered Zion? How did we go from there to there? What went wrong? This story, this book, these books together chronicle that journey. The first 11 chapters of the book of 1 Kings tell us the story of Solomon's life. Now, interestingly, of those 11 chapters, four of them deal with the building of the temple. And why that is because the author wants us to know that the most important thing that Solomon did with his life, the biggest legacy from his life, was the building of the temple. And that's what we've come to today. Today we're looking at the story of the building of the temple. Did anybody read your homework this week? Or maybe, there we go. I see a couple of hands going up. It was a lot of reading. Just so you know, where did you discover the homework? Half of you didn't even know. Exactly. So what happens is, every week, around about Thursday, Leanne will send out a little message on our broadcast group telling you which scriptures we're going to be preaching through on the Sunday. And that's in part because there's so many verses and chapters in the book of Kings, we're not going to get time to look at them all. And so invariably, we're looking at excerpts from a whole chunk, and you were sent the whole chunk that we're covering today. So you could have read that on your own before you came and then been prepared for this message. And some are. So today we're looking at 1 Kings chapter 6 to chapter 8, which covers a whopping 155 verses, long verses at that. So we're obviously not going to read them all. We'll go through in excerpts. The big idea in today's passage is this: God's glory shines out from his people. God's glory shines out, you want to almost say temple, from his temple, but then later from his people. God's glory shines out from his people. Chapter 6 opens up with a basic description of the temple. I'm mindful that actually for some of us, this is going to be a particularly interesting message. You're going to get to look at the intricacies of the detail of how the temple was built. For others of us, this is quite different than the normal sort of scriptures we look at, as this is quite a unique one. Lots of description. But I'm trusting that God's going to speak to us powerfully through all of these bits of imagery that we see woven through this text. Chapter 6, verse 1 opens like this. It was in mid-spring in the month of Ziv, during the fourth year of Solomon's reign, that he began to construct the temple of the Lord. So this chapter is about the building of the temple. This was 480 years after the people of Israel were rescued from their slavery in the land of Egypt. I thought we were supposed to be looking at the temple. Why are we talking about the Exodus? Well, somehow the author wants to connect these things. 480 years, actually 12 generations from when they were slaves in Egypt and the Passover freed them to now the temple is built. Why is this link so important? Well, do you remember a time when we used to save like songs and then use them as our alarm clocks? Did any of you ever do that? You'd like wake up and your favorite song would wake you up, right? So there was a stage in my life where there was a Matchbox 20 song called Let's See How Far We've Come that woke me up. The first lines of the song were hello, 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 hello. And then in comes the drum riff. Now, so what happens is this song is synonymous with a certain season of my life. I cannot hear it without remembering waking up in that season. Like, I think what's happening here is the author is saying to us something. Let's just see how far we've come here. It's 480 years, 12 generations. They left Israel as slaves. They left there to wander into the wilderness, nothing with what they could carry on their backs. And now, 12 generations later, here we stand, boom, in this critical moment, and the temple is being built. It's an extraordinary journey that Israel has been on. And finally, God is saying, the Exodus is over. God's people have got a home, a temple where I will live in their midst. The promise to Abraham has been fulfilled. The promise, I will make you into a great nation and all the nations of the earth will be blessed. When the temple is built, presence of God dwells in the midst. Israel become a light to the nations and all the nations of the earth will be blessed through them. And so God is actually saying, this is the fulfillment of what I began in Egypt. in the Exodus is now finally being fulfilled in the building of the temple. And then chapter 6 and chapter 7 continue, and they give us the details and a bit of a description of the temple. There's lots of statistics. I mean, if you're an architect, you're probably going to, or an artist, you're going to love this, right? There's statistics about the size and the materials. And we're going to go on a bit of a whistle-stop tour through the temple as we make our way through what God did in those people in that moment. But before we get into there, we need to know this. These verses are filled with symbolism and meaning. And we're going to look at what the symbolism and the meaning was behind so much of these things. And so let's go. Chapter 6, verse 2 and 3. The temple that King Solomon built for the Lord was 90 feet long, 30 meters, right? 30 feet wide, 10 meters wide, and 45 feet high. So that's a pretty much, 45 feet almost from Baptist, the back the row there to about here. That's how high the temple was. How wide? 10 meters. This is a 9-meter auditorium inside here and another 9 out the back. So you can pretty much imagine the width that's very similar in size to what we're currently in here, inside here. All that to say, the temple was quite small when you think about it. The whole of the nation, this is the day. It's actually quite small because it wasn't meant to be a meeting place. It wasn't meant to be a meeting place for lots of people. In fact, it was meant to be the dwelling place of God. And only a few would ever get inside there. The temple was the home of God's visible glory. There are three main sections to this temple. We read there, 45 feet high. The entry room at the front of the temple was 30 feet wide, running across the entire width of the temple. It projected outward 15 feet from the temple. Three main sections. You heard about the entry room. There's a porch on the front of the temple. Maybe we can pick. Can we put that picture up there, please, Nodin? I'll see if I can navigate us through this picture, just so you can see it. Oh, is it? See, there might be some images in that slide pack there. Yeah, maybe it's buried somewhere in there. Anyway, what it is, there's three parts to the temple. The first one is the porch. It's the veranda. It's the front section. It's kind of the interface between the courts where the people would gather, and then behind that, behind that would go into the second, the major section. So you've got the porch. The major section is called the holy place. It's the largest chamber in the temple. And then behind the holy place is the third smaller section called the Holy of Holies. Okay, so you've got the porch, the biggest section, the holy place. The holy place was where the priests could enter. Only the priests could enter into the holy place, no one else. But then behind the holy place, you went through the thick curtain, the veil, into the Holy of Holies, where only the high priest was allowed to enter. What I'm getting at here is not only is the temple small, it's very exclusive. It wasn't like there was a little lottery and everyone could go on their birthday or something and we could all go to the temple. It wasn't. It was very exclusive. Here was the porch to keep people out and to let people see. And then was the holy place. Only the priest could ever go inside here. And then only the high priest ever was allowed to go into the Holy of Holies. It was the place where the visible glory of God, the presence of God, would dwell in their midst. It was very exclusive. And in a sense, I want to say right from the outset when the temple was built, it was prophetic. It was showing that this temple is too small for God to live in. This temple is too small for all the people of God to know the presence of God. Something interesting about the temple's construction in verse 7. The stones that were used to construct this temple. The stones, let's read it, verse 7 together. The stones used in the construction of the temple were finished in the quarry. So they didn't finish the stones on site. So there was no sound of hammer or axe or any other iron tool at the building site, right? If you are familiar with building sites, maybe there's some of you who run building or construction businesses here. What's interesting about this building site is there'll be no power tools, so to speak. There's no iron tools here. This is all wood. It's all wooden tools. Why do you think that is? It's got to do with sound, actually. There's no stonework on the site. It was a silent building project. Right from the inception of the temple, it was meant to be a place of peace so that nothing disturbed the peace that was going to come through this building. Symbolic again, but that's what was happening. Michael Eaton says of the building of the temple, he says this, "The presence of God brings peace, not a peace of an easy life, but the peace of knowing that we are right with God and are enjoying God's presence. The temple was a place of peace. It brought God's peace to our lives. It had a place for making sacrifices, sacrifices of atonement of sin, sacrifices of atonement of sin that would bring about peace and reconciliation between God and man. We would be restored to Him through the temple that brought us peace. Now, something very interesting about its construction from verse 15 to 18, we see this. The entire inside from floor to ceiling was paneled with wood. Okay, so it's a stone building, stone structure, three parts. You can see this. Small porch, big holy place, small holy of holies, all out of stone. But the entire inside of the building is clad with wood. He paneled the walls and the ceilings with cedar. He used planks of cypress for the floors. The main room of the temple outside the most holy place was 60 feet long. Cedar paneling completely covered the stone walls throughout the temple, and the paneling was decorated with carvings of gourds, vegetables, and open flowers. Okay, so just try and imagine this with me in your minds. Yes, you've got a stone building from the outside. It pretty much, this part of the world is on top of a mountain in the Karoo. Imagine the Karoo. It's dusty. It's lots of rocks everywhere, right? Not a lot of vegetation around here. There's no long irrigation and greenery. It's dry and dusty. And then on the top of this mountain is a stone building. And then you're a priest and you walk through into the holy place. And this dry, dusty stone exterior, and suddenly you cannot see anything but wood around you. Wood carved with fruit and vegetables. Cedar wood, in fact. Now, cedar is interesting wood. It's got great insulating properties for temperature and for sound. So it's hot, it's dusty, it's all that outside. Suddenly it's calm and cool. But cedar also has a smell. I have beard wax in my beard right now. It's a very, very cool thing these days, apparently. I was given some at a preaching thing I was at. But my beard wax is the aroma of cedar. So if I'm nuzzling with anybody today, it's only going to be you, babe. It's only going to be you. It's the smell of cedar. Why cedar? Because cedar, and I'm telling you this, because cedar's got a strong smell. It's not just any wood. It's a strong smelling wood. So now you're dusty, it's dry, it's arid, it's rocky, it's stone building, and you walk into this place. All you see is wood, and wood carved in vegetables and carved in flowers, and you're overwhelmed with the smell of a forest. What's going on here? The priest is almost taken out of this world into a garden. What is it reminding you of? It's being the Garden of Eden. What's happening is right back then, God's people in God's presence in the Garden of Eden. Then God's people sinned and they're out of the garden. And now God is restoring a place of Eden. Eden was a place where the dwelling of God was with His people. They were together. They were in one place. And now God is restoring that. When sin entered the hearts of mankind, we were excommunicated out of the garden. We were put out, and there were cherubims, there were angels that were put there to guard, cherubims with flaming swords, to guard the way back into the garden. Angels put there to keep people out. So too, you will see again, cherubims put at the heart of the temple to welcome us back in, if you will. But I want us to see that the building of the temple is a restoration of Eden. Eden, a temple is not just the place where the presence of God is, but it's the place where the presence of God is with the people of God. God, I will be your God. You will be my people. I will dwell in your midst. It's a togetherness. It was together in Eden, then it was broken through sin. And ever since then, what God has been doing throughout history, the Exodus, everything leading up to the point where God would restore Eden. And what we've seen, it's in a very confined way. It's too small. It's exclusive. But it's been all about a restoring of Eden, the place where the people of God are back in the presence of God, where they dwell together in unity. That's what God's been doing here. Now, right in the middle of this construction of the temple, with all the descriptions that are going on, there's this interesting little sidebar, an interjection from God, if you will. Verse 11 and verse 12, then the Lord gave this message. It's 30 feet long and 20 cubits and carved with wood and da-da-da. Then the Lord, it just cuts in here. The Lord gave this message to Solomon concerning this temple that you are building. If you keep all my decrees and regulations and obey all my commands, if you I will fulfill through you the promise I made to your father, and I will live among the Israelites and will never abandon my people, Israel. It's an extraordinary promise. God kind of inserts this in the middle of the building project. Hey, let me just tell you how this thing's going to work. This is what you have to remember, Solomon. It's an amazing promise. I will live among the Israelites and I will never abandon my people. Amazing. But it's a conditional promise. If you keep my decrees and regulations and obey all my commands. But what's interesting about this condition here, if you, the you is not plural. This is not a word to the nation of Israel. This is a word to the king. It's an interesting thing about a king in that time in history in God's people was the king was the representative of the people. It was so with the faith of the king, so goes the fate of the people. The fate of the people is now tethered to the faith of the king. And so if Solomon is faithful, God will not abandon his people. He will remain in their midst. But if Solomon is not, well, then we start to drift to the rivers of Babylon, there where we wept. So with the heart of the king goes the fate of the people. Verse 23, remember the cherubim guarding the garden, keeping us from finding our way back. Verse 23, in the Holy of Holies, he made two cherubim of wild olive wood, each 15 feet tall, 5 meters tall. He placed them in the inner sanctuary. The wingspan of each of the cherubim was 15 feet, each wing being 7.5 feet long. The two cherubim were identical in shape and size. Just try and imagine this. Each was 15 feet tall. He placed them side by side in the inner sanctuary of the temple. Their outspread wings reached from wall to wall, while their inner wings touched at the center of the room. He overlaid the two cherubim with gold. I mean, it's a small room, but the small room is dominated by the impressive sight of these massive angels there, clad in gold, overarching in the whole space. The same two cherubim, if you will, that kept us out of the garden through our sin. Now God, the holiness of God, as we are welcomed in slowly through the priest to be restored to relationship with God again. These cherubim have their wings outstretched as if to say, we're here to worship. We're here to worship the king. We're ready to do his bidding. In a sense, this book is about a return to Eden for the people of God. It's a beautiful thing. And then chapter 7 takes an interesting break. Chapter 7 breaks from the building of the temple and starts to tell us about the building of Solomon's own palace. We're not going to get into the details there outside of we'll say the fact that it took almost twice as long to build Solomon's palace and it was substantially bigger than the temple. Commentators are mixed about what they think about that. Is he thinking he is more grandiose, etc., etc.? Or was it that the major event of his life was the building of the temple? That was the rush, that was the hurry, and actually I can take my time with my house because it's not as important. I don't know. There certainly were seeds in Solomon's heart already at this point that things were going awry. Then we pick up later on in chapter 7 with this another interesting description, a description of the sea, the great sea. Verse 23, then Huram cast a great round basin, 15 feet across from rim to rim. It was called the sea with a capital S. It was 7.5 feet deep and it was about 45 feet in circumference. It was encircled just below its rim by two rows of decorative vegetables. There were about six gourds per foot all the way around and they were cast as part of the basin. So you can imagine this extraordinary basin. It's made out of metal and they're woven into this here. Oh, there's this elaborate design of all these vegetables around this basin, this great big mighty basin. And verse 25, the sea, as it's called, was placed on a base of 12 bronze oxen, all facing outward. Three faced the north, three faced the west, three faced the south, and three faced the east. The sea was rested upon them. The walls of the sea were about 3 inches thick, and its rim flared out like a cup and resembled water, a water lily blossom. It could hold about 50,000 liters of water. Okay, again, remember symbolism, remember imagery. It's a very different world to the one you and I live in, but it speaks to us still today. This sea is this gigantic bowl of water. It's so big, it's called the sea. There's lots of different interpretations about what it means. I'm going to share with us three. It means cleansing, it means control, and it means calling. The first one, cleansing. Before anyone could enter the temple, you had to be cleansed, you had to be washed, you needed to be clean. And so God provided a means for being cleansed before you could come in. You couldn't clean yourself, no. God made provision for his priests to be clean and cleansed before they entered into his presence and had fellowship with them. God provided a means for the cleansing that would lead to fellowship. That's the sea. The second one is control. We live in the South Peninsula. It's not lost on me that the sea means something very different to us as what it did to them. The sea means to us leisure, hey? A sunset walk on the beach. Last week, was it Thursday? We had that most glorious day. We gobbled down supper and I suddenly said, enough. Let's jump in the car. We're driving to Chapman's Peak and we're going to sit on the top and watch the sunset over the sea, right? The sea for us is leisure. It's fun. It's rest. It's adventure, but not back then. Back then, the sea was danger. Back then, the sea was unpredictable, uncontrollable, uncertain. It was a place of death. Everybody knew someone who had drowned in the sea. It was a scary, unpredictable force of nature. And in a sense, at the heart of the temple, in the building of the basin, prophetically, it's saying, even this great, big, scary force of nature is contained within God's power. The sovereign Lord is in control of the whole world that he made. And then the last one is calling. It's no coincidence that there are 12 oxen facing the four different directions, the four corners of the earth and the 12 tribes of Israel. In other words, the people of Israel are given to carry the light to the four corners of the earth. The sea also, commentators have said, they represent the Gentiles, those outside of God's people. So now you've got this picture of, you've got these 12 oxen, the 12 tribes, who are propping up the Gentiles, holding them up to God. It's a picture of the calling of Israel to be a light to the nations. They were never meant to be blessed so that they could enjoy all the blessings to themselves. The blessing of God that we are celebrating in the climax, the building of the temple here, was never meant to be so that they could have so much fun together and enjoy all the provision of God themselves. It was meant, they were always meant to be facing outwards. You are a light to the nations. You are a blessing to the whole world. And this part of the temple was to remind Israel to bless the nations. Isaiah 56, verse 7. Even those I will bring to my holy mountain, the temple. I will make them joyful in my house, the temple of prayer. Their burnt offerings and their sacrifices will be acceptable on my altar. For my house, the temple, will be called a house of prayer for all the peoples, for all the nations. God's people were always meant to be outward facing. And this is built into the very structure of the temple, because in the midst of blessing, it's so easy that our lives get curved in and we draw a circle around ourselves and we keep it to ourselves. Israel were never allowed to do that. And then, chapter 8, finally, we see the temple is complete. It is finished. Finally, 12 generations after the Exodus. If you're familiar with the Bible, this can't be lost on us. They were slaves. They were oppressed. They were squashed. And God rescued them. They didn't do anything. It wasn't like they fought a big war themselves and they grew so strong and then they fought them off and they overthrew their captors. There's nothing like that. No. They were rescued. They were saved. How were they saved? They were saved by the blood of the Lamb that protected them when the angel of the Lord passed over and delivered them. And now, 12 generations, as they've wandered through the wilderness and made their way to the promised land, now God's dwelling is with his people. It's glorious. Chapter 8, verse 1. Then Solomon then summoned Jerusalem and all the elders of Israel. and all the heads of the tribes, the leaders of the ancestral families of Israelites, they were to bring the Ark of the Lord's covenant to the temple from its location in the city of David, also known as Zion. So all the men of Israel assembled before the King Solomon at the annual festival of shelters, which is held every autumn in the month of Ethanim. When all the elders of Israel arrived, the priests picked up the ark, and the priests and the Levites brought up the ark of the Lord along with a special tent and all the sacred items that had been in it. And there before the ark, King Solomon and the entire community of Israel sacrificed so many sheep and goats and cattle that no one could keep count. We read this in a very matter-of-fact way, but let's just think about it. Remember, we've heard there's so many men, it's like the sand on the seashore. You can imagine this little town. It's a little, small city. Jerusalem wasn't big in those days. Don't think city like you think. No. We're thinking, I think, a couple of thousand people. But all the surrounding people now have gathered from the whole region, as many as the sand and the seashore. And they gather around this mountain. Down the valleys, they're there. Up the side of the Kidron Valley, they're up the side as they all look across at this temple. So many people. Imagine a gathering like that. I think it would whip the pants off any Springbok rugby test match or soccer match. So many people singing and anticipating what's about to happen. It's a lot of pressure as well, I suppose. But then the smell. I don't think we think about this often enough. So many sheep and goats and oxen that you couldn't even count them. Now, you know that thing that, there should be a bylaw in the municipality against this, but you know when you arrive home late after work and you're starving and your neighbor has very selfishly lit a fire and is tanning some chops or roasting some vorse? You know that smell when you get there and you know it's spaghetti bolognese or it's butternut soup, right? Whatever. That's... But that guy has the audacity. You know that smell? God delights in the smell. As South Africans who braai, we should appreciate this, I think, more than any other culture, right? The smell of roasting meat. So many sheep and goats and oxen that you couldn't even count them. The whole city is overcome with the smell of braai. Because God delights in this beautiful smell that makes its way up to him. And then verse 6. And the priests carried the ark of the Lord's covenant into the inner sanctuary of the temple, the most holy place. And they placed it beneath the wings of the cherubim. And the cherubim spread their wings over the ark, forming a canopy over the ark and its carrying poles. And when the priests came out of the holy place, a thick cloud filled the temple of the Lord. The priests could not continue their service because of the cloud, for the glorious presence of the Lord filled the temple of the Lord. Remember the Exodus. How were the people of God led? By night was a pillar of fire. By day was a pillar of smoke. There was this cloud of smoke that was the presence of God that they followed through the wilderness as he showed them where to go. Now that same presence of God that was with them is now living in residency in the temple, in the Holy of Holies. They bring in the ark, not Noah's ark, the Ark of the Covenant. What did the Ark of the Covenant contain in there? The Ten Commandments. It was the holiness of God, if you will, in the heart of the temple where the presence of God dwelt in the midst of his people. And God showed up in such a profound way that the priests were literally driven out of the temple. They had to leave. They couldn't be there because the presence of God had finally come home to the temple. It's worth stopping and reflecting on Solomon here. I'm sure Solomon felt a measure of relief as well. Imagine you had built that temple for 7 years and they carry it in and the drums are playing and the people are cheering and they put it down and then nothing happens. A big dud. That is not what happens. Solomon's faith is what I'm commending here. He built. His whole life was lived. And there were cracks in his heart. We're going to see them next week. We'll see them the following week. There were big cracks that ultimately led to his demise and played a role in the demise of the whole of Israel. Broken as he was, because he was, God used him and his faith to do this extraordinary thing. So much so, the presence of God is there that the priests have to bail. They cannot remain in the facility. It's just too strong. And what God's in a sense doing is he's consecrating this place. He's saying it's not just an ordinary building. No, no, this is a sacred place. This is a holy place. This is a temple. This is my home on earth. Temple really, it's not building. It's not a special building as much as it represents the traffic, the interaction between God and his people. And it's finally finished. So what does it mean for our lives today? Well, I think there's a reason the Exodus is mentioned here, as I've said before. The Passover is how God began this and delivered his people. They were delivered through the protection that they received by the blood of another, an innocent, that was put over their doorposts in order to protect them. But the end game for God's people in the Exodus was not just their deliverance. The end game was always a restoration of Eden. It wasn't just freedom from bondage, but it was a restoration and right relationship with God. It was the presence of God in the midst of his people. I wonder if you hear it and you think salvation is just, well, then I can get to heaven one day when I die. Many people today, even Christians, you think salvation is just, well, just get me free from that and then I can go to heaven one day. But actually, that's not the end game for God's people here. It's not just freedom from the darkness and the difficulty that they faced in Egypt. No, no. The end game was a restoration of Eden, an Edenic lifestyle where the presence of God in the midst of his people, God's people restored into relationship with him and together living in the goodness of God and his presence in the midst of them, they became a light to the nations. God's invitation to you and me is not just, well, pray this prayer and then you can get your ticket and you've got insurance one day when you die. But God invites us into recreating Eden on earth. He invites us to a communal life whereby we live in his presence and we get to be light to his, to the nations, to the people who are looking in on us. So much so that even the trajectory of the temple, as exclusive as it was always outward looking. So much so that even when Solomon dedicated the temple, look at the words that he prays in verse 27. But will God really live on earth? Solomon prays. Will God really live on earth? Why? Even the highest heavens cannot contain you. How much less this temple that I've built? I mean, this is the glory moment of his life, of the people of Israel. And even in that, he's looking at it going, this is too small for the glorious God that I know and serve. God is going to be in the whole world. There's no literal temple now these days. The temple was destroyed. It was destroyed multiple times. The last time himself, Jesus declared its destruction coming, and he declared it its end, if you will. In a sense, he declared its end because he himself became the true and better temple. Jesus himself became the true and better temple. Jesus himself becomes our ultimate high priest, who goes into the holiest place on our behalf, who provided as himself not only the high priest, but he became the sacrifice himself. Perfect, blameless, spotless, unlike any sacrifice that could ever be. He stepped into that place in order that you and I, who would never otherwise be allowed to go into the holy place, the holy of holies, are now welcomed in because of the perfect priest and the perfect sacrifice on our behalf. We have restoration in relationship to God. It's an extraordinary thing that Christ has done. But I hope you can see how this temple enhances our understanding of our great Savior Christ. Jesus is the fulfillment of that too small, too confined temple in order that you and I can be restored into a kind of Eden whilst we're on earth in exile even now. As the church, Jesus cleanses us and he makes us fit for God's presence in a way that the great sea never could. He washes us. He cleanses our consciences. He cleanses our hearts and he makes us right in our standing before God. And we collectively, as the body of Christ, become a temple which God manifests himself and shines a light to the nations. 1 Corinthians 3:16, Paul writes to the church in Corinth, don't you realize that all of you together are the temple of God? Look around you. The sea, the oxen, the gourds, the vegetables, the cedar, the stones, you and I, Don't you realize that all of you together are the temple of God and that the Spirit of God lives in you? God will destroy anyone who destroys this temple, for God's temple is holy and you are that temple. I mean, as much as we've made much, and I know strange gourds and wood and cedar and very different than our world, but we've made much of this great building of God. God says, as amazing as that was, it doesn't hold a candle to you guys. You are the temple. You are holy. You are God's new temple. Jesus built a temple through his life and his death and his resurrection and ascension. And then he filled us with his Spirit at Pentecost. Jesus built a new temple that will never be destroyed. And you and I are part of it. As much as each brick in this wall forms part of the fabric of this wall, you and I make a temple, each of our lives, different. As I said, I wish some of these bricks were more blemished and broken, because that's probably a more fitting description of many of our lives. But they're in you nonetheless. Why? Because they're perfect. No, because Jesus was perfect on our behalf. And together we become a temple in which God manifests himself in his presence, that we can know him. And then as he meets with us and he nourishes us and he builds us up and he transforms us, he sends us out into the world, scattered at times together to be light to others, so that the world may know those four corners of the earth that the oxen represent, the gospel light going out to the South Peninsula and beyond. Why? Because Christ, from now until he returns, wants an Eden in the South Peninsula. That's what the church is. It's a restoration of Eden. That our part of the world, this South Peninsula, will always have a holy mountain, a bride and a body, a sanctuary where the triune God dwells by his Spirit, where light can shine out from and renew God's world. Our big idea today: God's glory shines out from his people. Can we stand together? Can we sing and worship? Jesus, as we stand before you, we declare now that as wonderful and as glorious as that temple was, you are the true and better temple. You were the perfect, sinless sacrifice. You were the ultimate high priest. You became a mediator, and you stepped into the Holy of Holies. And when you were sacrificed, that veil that separated us out was torn in two, in order that your presence would burst forth the confines of the temple to fill the whole earth, not bypassing each of our individual lives. Jesus, it's worth acknowledging before you right now that it is not our goodness, it is not our ability to clean up our own lives, but it is your sacrifice. It is your cleansing. It is your atonement that washes over our sinfulness and our brokenness, that we can be cleansed. Our consciences can be cleansed, and we can have fellowship with the Father. We can have fellowship with one another, that we become a temple in which you live, Lord Jesus.